originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, together again in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and happy to have you with us, tuned in to the show trainers listen to. So many trainers around the country have told us that they like to listen to this program to hear what their peers are up to, and we have a good one for you tonight here on Sirius 219, XM 201, and of course for everyone tuning in worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. JT, we were kind of reminiscing before we came on air. And by the way, our guest tonight is in studio with us here in Lexington, which is always a nice treat. But we were reminiscing before we came on air. You and our guest tonight kind of go back a little ways, don't you?
Yeah, longer than we'd care to admit. We still look exactly the same as we did 30 years ago. So I don't know if there's much difference. But yeah, we've known one another a long time, and I've enjoyed watching his horses run, cashed a few tickets over the years. He's a guy I like to bet on, always seemed to pay good. So,
and still is. And he grew up in Ohio. He spent 3 years riding races in Florida, recording 218 wins in the saddle before eventually moving to California to work on the backside and then open a public stable in 1995. He has saddled 219 winners with more than $7.5 million in purses. How about this? Seven of his 33 starters so far in 2019 have found themselves standing in the winner's circle, and 13 of those 33 have finished in the top three. Yeah, he's pretty good. He is trainer James Chapman, and he is with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. James, thanks for coming to the studio. Appreciate the visit.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. What a ride, huh?
It's been
quite a journey.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. How does a kid growing up in Ohio become hooked on horse racing and then eventually find a career in it?
Oh, I was raised on a farm, and I mean, that's what my family's done the whole time, so it was just kind of a natural thing to do. I didn't like school, so it's just what I like to do.
What part of Ohio?
Cleveland, south of Cleveland.
Okay. Would you go to the races up there?
Our farm was like 60 miles away, and I couldn't drive till I was 16, so a lot of times we went back and forth, but yeah, all the summers and as much as I could, I was at the racetrack.
How big was the farm you were raised on?
120 acres.
Horses?
Yeah, we had a bunch of horses. My dad had a horse that won the Ohio Derby in 67, and he stood him there, so we had a lot of horses by that sire.
Who is that horse?
Out the Window.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you stand a sire, money goes out the window.
Fast.
It's a hard life, huh? Having a farm. I mean, did you find that when you were growing up, or were you just like devil may care and your dad had to worry about it? But isn't it kind of, you know, being in the horse business and all the ups and downs, it can be a little tension filled.
Yeah, I mean, I took it on early, and I mean, it's really never been like work to me. It's just, I can't wait to get up in the morning since I was 12 or 13 years old. So
people don't understand that.
They either have it or you know.
They always say, how could you get up every morning at 4:30 every day of the year, you know? And you do have that feeling, I think, that I can't wait to get out there and see the horses and, you know, see what's going on and get into the day. It's always so exciting. I mean, every day is like that.
Yeah, mine, it's always been a challenge for me because I started riding on my 16th birthday, and it took me a year to get my weight down to be able to ride. And so it's, you know, there's always been a challenge as far as, and that's, you know, that's what I like about it. It's always trying to put the puzzle piece together.
As you were growing up, did you think, okay, I want to be a jockey? Did you ever think that you were going to be a horse trainer?
Yeah, early on. I mean, I was the youngest, as far as I know, it's still as of the day. I was the youngest person ever licensed a gallop horse. I was galloping horses when I was 11. And at the same time, taking horses of only my father's to the post in the afternoon with a pony. So I knew a lot. But the problem was I started growing. And I got up to 145, I think, when I was 14. So I had to get it down. And then I had to go to school and hold it for a year. That was the hardest thing. And then on my 16th birthday, I started riding and got a tutor to go around with me. So, I mean, I only went to real school till like 10th grade.
What do you remember about that first time you got a leg up onto a racehorse?
It was fun. Like I said, I was getting on them way before I was licensed. So, yeah, it's I don't really remember the first time, actually.
There's been so many since, right? Yeah.
Your sister was a rider, was she?
Yeah, right after I quit, she started, and she did really well. She... I quit. I actually rode for 5 years, and she started in 92 when I went to California. She just kind of like picked right up. She'd never even messed with horses that much, and she was riding like a year later.
Wow. Is she the only sibling that's involved in the sport?
Yeah. I had another sister that trained, but she's not training anymore. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I got four sisters, yes.
Any brothers?
No. No brothers.
Wow.
Lucky guy.
The only Colt. The only Colt. He's trainer James Chapman. He is our guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Tell us a little bit more about your dad. He was involved in the business for a very, very long time.
Yeah, he had a trucking company. And then he claimed that horse that won the Ohio Derby for $6,250 that year, maybe. And then he kind of started full time from there. He it just kind of kicked right off for him from there.
Was it a passion for him?
Yeah, he loved. I mean, I think he messed around with horses when he was younger, but that's kind of, from what I know, is kind of when he started.
Do you remember going to races to watch his horses run? I mean, I know you were galloping some of those horses, but
I mean, I was when I was 8, I was helping in the barn. I mean, I was doing. Yeah, I mean, it's from the beginning, way back.
It's amazing the way this sport just gets in your blood.
Yeah, I really never started. It just happened from the beginning, from the very beginning.
And you're like so many other trainers that we've had on this program over the years. You started off as a jockey and then moved on to the training side of things. Does that benefit you now?
I think so, because I can read horses pretty good. You know, there's a lot of things that if you haven't been on a horse that you can sit there and say, well, like especially situations in races to where you'll see trainers blame a rider for this and for that, and it's like, nothing to really blame. This thing's happened, and I think it's helped me.
Yeah, it certainly gives you a little bit better understanding of what goes on. I always try to explain to people the riders are, you know, in a three-dimensional situation. We're sitting there watching from the sidelines. Being in it is a whole different kettle of fish.
You know? Yeah, I find it interesting, like when people say, oh, you know, you got that horse in trouble, or why'd you let that horse cut you off? It's like when the gas tank's empty, there's nothing. I mean, if you watch Calvin Burrell when he won on that horse, Mind That Bird, it's like he wasn't getting cut off because he was going to run up through, you know, he made that happen. But up at the 3/8 bowl, a lot of stuff happens. The horses realize who they are, and that's where a lot of things happen that's where a lot of races are won. I mean, up in the turns where it happens.
That's a great comment. Talk about the horses knowing who they are.
Well, I mean, you can see horses out in fields. I mean, if you feed horses all the time, young horses, I mean, the horse that comes first to eat's the first same horse that comes first to eat every day. And I think horses sense it. I think horses sense it. I think they even sense it in the post parade. I think they know.
Yeah, I think
they just
so
know.
Too.
And they really know up there at the 3/8 bowl when it's time to start running.
Yeah.
And that's why you'll see a lot of horses that'll take class drops and boom, they win by 10, but they got beat by 20 the race before, you know, up above their head. It's just they know. And the same as, like, you'll see a claiming race going 109 and change and then a grade one going 9-3. Well, it doesn't matter. That claiming horse was not going to win the, you know.
Right. Well, it's funny because you know in the paddock sometimes the way they come over and they look around and they go, I can beat this group, you know. And you just get that feeling when you've been around them a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of things I think that they know that we don't understand.
And people don't believe it if you tell them that.
I mean, when you're a kid in school and going to kindergarten or first grade the first time, I mean, you can know the bully before he starts to open up his mouth. It's just things that they know.
Yeah.
Well, and we've had several trainers come on the show over the years and say, yeah, I can tell when the horses are really, really young, when they're in the field and they're running around. And a lot of breeders will tell us that too. There's just something they have that it factor. There's something special about certain horses.
Yeah, that's why I like to buy young horses, and I've been able, blessed to be able to have farms and where I can watch horses, and I'll buy a lot of cheap horses that don't cost a lot of money, and you can see, you know, you can see, you can just see a lot, you know, just as, it's a different angle.
What qualities are you looking for when you're buying those horses?
Well, I've never really had the money to be able to go out and buy, like, the Baffert horses that they give. Not that he gives a lot of money or he does now, but I'll buy a lot of horses with pedigree that are crooked or have faults or maybe, you know, I mean, a chip in a back ankle can be the difference between $75,000 at a sales price is just, you know, an x-ray report or something. And I've learned what I can and can't fix. To say one certain thing, I mean, they all kind of look the same, the ones I buy. They have to have a really good walk, and if they don't walk good, they're not going to gallop good. They're not going to run good. So, I mean, you know, it's not a small circle that I buy out of, but I don't know. I see it. I've bought a lot of good horses. I bought Dortmund and sold him as a two-year-old. I bought him as a yearling. Corfu were some of my later ones. But, yeah, it's just they all kind of look the same, and I kind of try to buy the horses that the real rich guys are passing on because of, like I say, crooked or vet issues or something like that, to whereas, you know, if they can run, there's a huge upside, and they kind of look past that as far as selling them down the road.
You talk about Dortmund and selling him as a two-year-old. Do you ever look back and say, oh, man, I wish I didn't let that one go?
I probably wouldn't have to be sitting here right now. I mean, I'd still be doing it, but I would have never been able to run him in the Derby because I wouldn't have owned him. But, yeah, I mean, he was just he was a good horse. I needed the money at the time, and they bought him. That's where he was there. I thought he'd bring more money, but they said he was too big and big brown and, you know, all the stuff and long in the pasterns and the same old deal. And I kind of believed it a little bit, so I, like, just moved him on. But he was a monster.
Yeah.
He was a monster.
What'd you like about him?
He was just what I liked. He was a big, rangy, I mean, you just see it. I mean, lot of people passed on him. I mean, they passed on him as a weanling.
Yeah.
And it's just, everybody basically said he was too big, but when you go in to Saratoga in the grade ones, they're all big.
Yeah.
And a lot of horses will grow fast, and they'll kind of peak at a yearling as far as what their height is. He never grew a lot more, actually, from the yearling to on. He didn't grow a lot more. But, he was a beautiful horse.
It's like going into a bar. You know which girl right away you're going to go after.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. There's usually just one.
One
right?
Trip to the bathroom, you got a nail.
Yeah, it's looking at horses the same way. They either strike you or they don't.
Yeah. It takes, like, when I'm at sales, I mean, a lot of people get mad at me when I go to look at horses, but it's like two steps and I'm pretty much know where I'm at.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible that it can happen that quickly, you know. But I guess when you've been doing it for so long and you have that eye that you talked about, it just kind of comes to you when you start looking at horses, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
James Chapman with us here on Trainer Talk, the show presented by Fasig Tipton. And one thing you brought up, James, is something that I taught to the folks at the sales quite often about, the fact that you can find horses that are really good racehorses that maybe have a little blemish on the vet report or don't scope quite perfectly, whatever it might be, and they turn out to be great racehorses, and so often they're overlooked at the sale, and they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, I can't deal with a horse that scopes bad. I mean, it'll change. Scopes will change a little bit from time to time, mm-hmm. but if the scope's the biggest thing to me, if they can't breathe, they can't run.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. When you were riding down in Florida and you made the decision to move to California, start working on the backside, then eventually open up your own operation, talk about that time in your life and what led to that decision.
Well, actually I started riding in Ohio, Thistledown.
Okay.
And then, we would go to Florida in the winters, and I was actually doing really well at the time. Always fought my weight bad. Like, every day for 5 years straight. I never got hurt to have a vacation or to have time off, or I probably would have never made it back. But Hurricane Andrew came through, and I was actually riding a horse at Churchill for a guy named Steve or Mike Trevigno, I think. And it was before cell phones, so there was not a lot of communication. And I was flying back and trying to get a hold of Jock's room to let him know I was going to be late because the planes were held up, and it was actually Hurricane Andrew. So everything was shut down for like a week, and I just... You know, my dad said, if you could have a chance to be an assistant for Wayne Lucas, would you stop riding and quit this fight, you know, quit. And I was, like I say, it was like the best I'd ever done at that time as far as winning races and stuff. And I said, and I just said, yeah. And so.
What'd you have to do to keep your weight down?
Oh, you don't want to know.
I mean, jockeys go through hell trying to do that.
I mean, my kitchen bill in the jocks room, mine and Randy Romero's, and it was more than what we made a week. You know, I did a lot of things that you shouldn't do, and luckily, knock on wood, as far as I know, I'm still fine, and Lasix and Totbox and everything. Everything you could do. I couldn't eat anything, basically. I couldn't keep anything. It was funny after... When I quit riding, the last horse I rode, I was heavy the last horse, because I rode one horse after the hurricane. The guy let me ride one horse that I'd been working. Yeah. I told the clerk of scales, I said, you'll never see me again. He didn't even make me check. I was probably 125 pounds. But within five days, I was 160, 155 or 160, just from keeping water. And yeah, my equilibrium kind of went. I got splotches all over my skin, and my whole body went into a shock. But
wow,
yeah.
Do you ever miss it?
I mean, there's nothing like that.
No. Not the battle with the weight.
No,
but do you ever miss the riding
like
side of
riding
it?
A race.
Yeah,
there's nothing like riding a race. Yeah, that's the most exciting thing. I mean, I love to win races as a trainer, and but the excitement of, unless you've done it, there's nothing like it.
You mentioned the name Randy Romero, Hall of Famer. Best jockey that you ever rode with?
Probably. Well, I rode with Shoemaker on his farewell tour. He came through Thistledown.
He was pretty good.
I mean, he rode a race, but I mean, I was really close with Jacinto Vasquez. We had the same valet. I never rode with the guys in California, but mainly the Eastern guys. I mean, Calvin Burrell, when I was in New Orleans, we rode together there. A lot of guys are, you know, DeSormo gave me, I rode a horse at Laurel when DeSormo had the bug, and I remember I needed to ride back to the barn to get on the van to go back home, and he was like, oh, I'll take you, and he was a little red Porsche, and that was pretty cool. to the where he's riding my horse today, and he rode a lot of horses for me, but I rode with a lot of good riders.
What was the best horse you ever rode?
The best horse was probably a horse called Key Colony. He was one of the top horses in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't ride any like great horses because it was mainly Ohio and Florida and stuff. But I won stakes on that horse. There was another filly called Royal Vegas. Actually, she's produced some pretty nice horses. I rode her. I didn't ride like now. There's great horses and stuff. But I mean, yeah, I rode some nice horses.
When you go through a catalog, do you see some of the fillies that you used to ride that have producers now and stuff?
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. That's, like I say, a lot of, it was Florida and Ohio horses, so you don't see, like, the horses to where you'd be riding in California and stuff and see that kind of pedigree hang on.
So what led to the decision to go out to California?
When you we talked Wayne about Lucas Wayne angle. Lucas. So, anyways, Mark Henning had just gone out on his own at that time, so we called Mark because we knew Mark from Tampa back when we were kids. And to get Wayne's number, and Mark kind of just said, look, I need an assistant. And so that was it. So I drove out there. Yeah. And that's when he just started for Team Valor, or he just started.
Right. So you actually never did work for Wayne? You
never,
for
no.
Mark.
No.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, Mark's doing good, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, every year he has big numbers.
Yeah, I call him the 67 million-dollar man, because that was like 3 or 4 years ago when he was on this show. But now he's way past that, so he corrects me all the time.
It's kind of funny because before I went to California, I went ahead and got my assistant license, just got it to take out there, because I knew that if they saw where I was riding races 3 weeks earlier, they'd probably give me a little trouble. But they made me retake the test and everything, and I galloped horses and was his assistant for maybe 2 years, and then he went back east and I stayed in California.
What makes a guy like Mark Henning such a good trainer?
Oh, I think, well, I mean, he has a great work ethic and a routine, and he's got the Lucas, which I picked up a lot from Mark, from discipline and the structure and stuff that I had never been around, because I'd never worked for anybody.
Yeah.
I'd just been around my dad's horses. And so I learned a lot. I mean, they're just discipline, and there's a structure, and there's, they, They, funny story is, my son, who was my age when I went out there, is Dallas Stewart's head assistant now. He's at Oakland.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so he's kind of like, he's taking the same
Lucas tree.
Yeah, yeah. Lucas is the best. I mean, he's, as far as a teacher, I mean, there's no better.
So many trainers have come on this program and said those same words.
I don't know what you want to call it. There's a pattern that you have to follow.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah. Even to this day, he is still extremely structured. And if you go to his barn, it's manicured perfectly.
Yeah. It's the way he deals with the help, and he trusts people. You know, it's just the delegates authority great, and order and structure. And
yeah, the organization itself is...
It's not a factory, but it's like a... It's a
well-oiled machine.
Yeah, and they're all the same. Yeah. I mean, and that's why it works.
So your son didn't want to work with dad?
He wanted to go to Dallas Stewart? Oh, we tried it a little bit. Him and his mother used to gang up on me. I said that it would probably be best if he had somebody else to answer to for a while.
Hey, I can relate to that. I worked with my dad for a very, very long time, and then
moved
to Kentucky.
He's done really well. Yeah. He's come a long way fast.
Yeah, it's funny how with kids, too, you can, and I'm sure it's the same thing with you and your son, you can tell them one thing. Dallas can tell them the exact same thing, but when it comes from Dallas, it comes from
He's
Dallas. When it comes
get
from
the
you,
finger, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And he didn't, as a young kid, he didn't really have the drive for it really early on like I did. He would rather be, you know, he was raised in California, he would rather be skateboarding and riding BMX bikes. But he picked it up late the last few years with me. Or, you know, but he's done well.
It's funny how the kids eventually come around. If you're in the horse business, sooner or later, they're gonna come around. It might not be early, but
I have a daughter that you couldn't pay her to go to the barn. She's really? In Colorado, older than him, and she never had she had zero interest.
Oh, really?
We tried. We gave her. She took riding lessons with my wife and stuff. Like at 5, 7 years old, she has.
What does she do?
She's an event planner for. Something out in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
And she's went to college. She's real smart, and she's moved right up the ladder there.
But your son always knew he wanted to follow in your footsteps.
He liked the money that came with it. Yeah, he liked the things he got from seeing horses win. And I'll never forget. I went to the grandstand with him one time, and I had trained City Zip. I broke his maiden. I had him the first two starts, and he was always going to go to Linda Rice. But I think I was at Churchill with Caller One. So, anyways, I had that horse and. So when Ghost Zapper, I was watching him, Frankel had him, which was City Zip's brother, I was watching him, and they started him, they put like Valdivia on him, and everything kind of off kilter a little bit for him, and he went off at 13-1 or 12-1 the first time at Hollywood Park, and I took him up there, and I bet a little money on him, and the horse won, and they gave me a pack, a $5,000 pack, and so... He was always like, "Oh, I want a pack and a pack of a wrap on it."
More wrappers.
That was probably one of his first lights that turned on in the horse business.
That's great.
I think that's why I'm hooked on craps when I go to the casino, because I would stand behind my father. My father played craps all the time, and I would stand behind him. He didn't want me playing with him because I was considered a jinx, and he didn't want my money on the same table as his. So every time the guy would make one of his numbers, he would turn around, and he would hand me $5. He would hand me $5. And I stood there all night long, and by the end, I had a few $100 in my pocket. I would go to the blackjack table. I would blow it in 30 seconds, and then I'd come back and stand behind him again. But I think that's why I like crap so much, because I saw that allure of, you know, being able to get that pack every time.
Right.
Fast money.
I found out when I started playing myself, it wasn't as easy.
No.
As we know. As we well know. James Chapman visiting with us in studio here in Lexington, Kentucky, our Jimmy Johns of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. James, a few minutes left before we have to get to our break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and talk about so many of the top horses that you had the chance to be around, including a horse by the name of Caller One, who I'm sure there's some great stories involved there. We'll talk about him, too, in the second half of the program. But back to your son here for just a minute. If you could give him, and I'm sure you have, one key piece of advice about going down this career path, what's it going to be?
I think the main thing is to not get too high and too low, just to tomorrow's another day. If you win or if you lose, to not let it, because it'll mess with your head. It'll mess with your head a lot. So, yeah, that's the main thing, is just to stay even, stay humble. You know, because it's, you know, if you're winning, if you're losing 80% of the time, you're doing well. So you're going to lose. And he's not a good loser. but yeah, that's the main thing, I think, is just don't try to, because if you go and start trying to change things, and I mean, it'll drive you crazy.
How do you balance the highs and the lows of this game?
I've had so many through the whole time that I've been doing this that I just, every day to me is a new day. And I try to fix the main mistakes that I made the day before, whether it be training or situations with a rider or whatever. And that's the key, is just to not try to just stick with the key of what works and try to fix the bumps. And it all works itself out, because the horses are 99% of it. And, you know, they've got a new chance every day.
Well, I mentioned we're going to talk about so many of the high points in the second half of the program here, and there have been several. But if you could go back and do one thing differently, what would it be?
I don't know that I changed a lot. I mean, well, the one thing that I did would do differently is when I was pinhooking in Florida, I was making all the good decisions and the right moves with buying horses that were inexpensive to buy low and sell high. And then I started doing really well and got involved with some people that tried, you know, that wanted to get involved in me because they saw that. And we started buying high, and the circle was like five people to sell to, and I lost a ton of money doing that, like lost everything.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the only thing. But as far as what I do every day, I don't think I change a lot.
You got a system that works, and sometimes when things are going bad, if you just go back to basics, right, it turns around right away.
Well, they asked Baffert when he, or Lucas, somebody, they asked when he was in a slump, you know, what he had done to perk things back up, and he said he started to feed faster horses or something. They asked him if he changed his feed program. He said, yeah, just the horses that I'm feeding. But yeah.
Can it be difficult to maintain the faith in your philosophy and your approach to training horses when you're going through a slump?
Yeah, you question yourself, but you just have to be strong enough and disciplined enough to know, look, this happened 5 years ago. This is what happened. It bounced back, or that changed, and just stay the course and do what you know that works, that got you to the point where you're at.
Yeah. The late, great Mike Mitchell, I was 0 for 42 or something at Sandy, and I was in a bad mood. And he told me one morning, he said, I see those horses you run. They're no good. Get rid of them all. Fire every client that you've got that has these bad horses. Yeah. And just keep, I went from like 18 horses to 7. And I did. I went home. I called everybody. I said, these horses have to go. They're not good enough to run Sandy. And it changed my whole career around, basically. I went to Hollywood Park within 2 weeks. I won 6 races in 1 week. I got the best client I ever had in my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's, sometimes you just have to start at the beginning again.
Yep.
Well, James Chapman is our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to step away for a quick 2-3 minute break. We'll come back second half of the show. We'll tell you all about some of those top horses that James had the privilege to be around throughout his career, and we'll tell you about what the future might hold. That's all next. Stay with us. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Nominate now to the 2019 Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Selected 2-Year-Old and Training Sale. The Gulfstream Sale was the number one ranked 2-year-old sale in 2018 by ROR on pinhooks and percentage of profitable pinhooks, with an average of more than $385,000 and a median of $295,000. And more horses sold for $1 million or more than any other 2-year-old sale in America last year. It's the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 27th, 2019. Nominate now at FasigTipton.com.
Now standing at Buck Pond Farm, Bet on Red, Wildcat Red.
Wildcat Red runs away to an impressive score in the Hutchison.
After winning the Grade 3 Hutchison, Wildcat Red goes on to win the Grade 2 Fountain of Youth in near record time. Faster than Pulpit, faster than Thunder Gulch, and faster than 49er. Multiple graded stakes winner and Grade 1 performing millionaire, Wildcat Red. Also standing at Buck Pond, V.E. Day. After winning 3 in a row at Belmont and Saratoga, V.E. Day wins the Grade 1 Traverse in one of the most exciting finishes in history with a speed rating of 112.
But here comes V.E. Day with a final try. Who will win the Traverse? It will be too close to call.
Major League Belmont and Saratoga talent, V.E. Day. For more information, contact Buck Pond Farm at www.buckpond.com.
You know, it's never too late to start talking racing at Woodbine. Major race dates you can look forward to later this year include the Woodbine Oaks on June 8th, the Queen's Plate June 29th, the Woodbine Mile September 14th, the Grade 1 Summer in Natalma Stakes on September 15th, and the Grade 1 Canadian International October 12th. Opening day at Woodbine, April 20th, turf racing beginning mid-May. Tickets on sale for the two-day Queen's Plate Festival right now. Visit woodbine.com/Queen's Plate.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizou with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
After becoming the only two-time Breeders' Cup Classic winner ever, Tisnow was just getting started. The leading first crop sire of his generation has now sired 15 Grade 1 winners to date. From brilliant sprinters to classic winners, Tisnow's progeny are always in demand, boasting a lifetime yearling average of $157,000, higher than Quality Road and Into Mischief. Book now. Book Tisnow. A proven choice for almost every mare.
Talking with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, what do flare strips do?
Mike, I still hear people ask, is there something wrong with that horse? It's got that thing on its nose. It's kind of like asking, is there something wrong with that jockey? He's got that helmet on his head. Both helmets and the strips are for protection. The strips are proven to protect horses by reducing lung bleeding, conserving energy, and reducing fatigue. The strips are simply a tool to help keep horses healthy so they perform their best.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
As they come to the 400 meters mark, the whips are out. It's Caller One, Extra Heat, Echo Eddie on the far side. They're fighting it out. Caller One in the center of the track. Echo Eddie and Extra Heat. Caller One and Echo Eddie get away from Extra Heat. It's Caller One and the grey Echo Eddie. They're striving. The whips are cracking. The hearts are pounding. It's Caller One with his head in front. Echo Eddie kicking again. Caller One wins it again. Caller One from Echo Eddie. Extra Heat third. Then Men's Exclusive, Broad Appeal, Bonapour, Captain Rio, Crystal Magician, Conroy, Muda Mayes, Denon AF, Misty Eyed, and Cacique Bar.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on HRRN. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, and our Jimmy Johns of Lexington Broadcast Studios. Caller One winning that Dubai Golden Shaheen for the second consecutive year in 2002. What a moment it was for our special guest on Trainer Talk tonight. That is trainer James Chapman. We'll continue our visit with him coming up momentarily, but want to remind you that if you did miss any portion of this show, simply head back to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. Listen at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Well, James, what a moment that was. We figured we'd give you a little trip down memory lane. Again, winning it for the second consecutive year. Take us back to that moment when Caller One crosses the finish line.
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, like I say, he was a great horse. It was good times.
Is he one that you purchased?
My dad bought that horse with Rolf Obrecht as a yearling, and then he tried to run him through the 2-year-old sale. Ran off in the Breeze Show. Was supposed to go a quarter. He ended up probably going a half a mile, and I think he had a 195 reserve, which 200 would have bought him, and somebody, Gary Contessa, went to 190, and lucky enough, we got him back.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. He was a bilateral ridgeling, so they paid a lot of money for him as a weanling, like 280, and then my dad bought him for 100, and then after his third start, he got really mean and was trying to bite horses when he ran, so we went ahead and had to surgically take his testicles out, and then he got really good.
He was the son of Phone Trick, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, super fast one. 11 of 29 lifetime starts. He earned more than $3.2 million, ran in the Breeders' Cup Sprint a couple of times, never won, but he was close.
Close.
Yeah, very close in, I think, 2001, right?
Kona Gold, the year Kona Gold won, I think he was the closest. He was third 1 year.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That was Squirtle Squirt.
Squirtle
and extra
Squirt.
Heat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, he was beaten a half a length and a neck. That's got to be tough
to
handle,
tough.
Huh?
Yeah, it was tough. That was Frankel's first Breeders' Cup win.
Yeah.
Oh, it was Squirtle Squirt.
Squirtle Squirt. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. He was a good horse, too.
Yeah, he could run a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't as good as Collar One, I don't think.
No, he was. I think that was the day he broke bad, and then they went 20 and change. Might have been that race. I mean, it was the fastest quarter for a long time in the history. I think that was the race.
We talked earlier about your ability to pick up on good horses at a very early age and even seeing them out in, on the farm. When did you know Collar One was special?
Oh, right off the bat. I mean, he showed it right off the bat. He had a little shin issue when he came to me, and then first time we ran him, it was like he was going to be a slam dunk, and we ran into High Yield. He beat us. And then the next time...
It's a bit of hard cheese.
Yeah.
then he was able to go on, and he beat Dixie Union in the second start. So those were his two maiden races. And then he won an A other than at Del Mar, and then we ran him in a stake, and then, like I said, then we had to operate on him to take care of his bilateral deal, and yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he won here at Keeneland in Lexington, took the Lafayette Stakes, then ran in the Derby Trial.
He won the Hansel on the dirt over at
Turfway. The Turfway, that's right.
And then he came and won the race at Keeneland, and then we tried him once to see if he'd go long in that race, and it was a mistake. We shouldn't have done it, but anyways, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. It didn't affect him. He came back and rattled off a few consecutive victories after that Derby Trial. So,
yeah.
Do you worry about that when you say, okay, we're going to find out what we have here. Let's see how far he can go. Do you worry about kind of destroying his confidence a little bit? Is that ever a concern?
I mean, you got to be careful with horses like him because they're so focused and fast and you know, it was more of my dad and the owners wanting to try it just in case that, you know. Bruce Headley was kind of in the same thing with Kona Gold. He never tried it. That horse was by Java Gold, and he never, which is route, pedigree,
yeah.
Right? He never ran him long.
Yeah, it seems like most of the Java Golds, they turned out to be sprinters
right.
For whatever reason. Mm-hmm. That gene seemed to be, the sprint gene seemed to be prominent in there.
Right.
Well, he finished fourth in the Breeders' Cup sprint behind Kona Gold in 2000. That was the first time he ran in the Breeders' Cup sprint when it was at Churchill Downs. Then he came back, and he was second in the Malibu. Went to the Dubai Golden Shaheen. When did you decide, okay, we're going to go to Dubai with this horse? We think he fits in that race.
The first time or the second?
The first time.
The first time. Well, that was kind of when it was somewhat new. And Martin Panza was the racing secretary, and he was on the committee out there. I didn't even know where Dubai
Boy, I
was.
I forgot about that.
And they and so he said, hey, look, you know, you want to have an invite for that horse? And I said, sure. Yeah.
What do you remember about going to Dubai for the first time once you figured out where the hell it was?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was fall first class airplanes. My sister went on the plane with the groom, and it was nice. It was all first class.
Was it as big of a production then as it is now with all the pageantry surrounding it and all the things that they do?
I think so.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's been a long time. I mean, it's at a different racetrack now, but yeah, I mean, it was great. You had a driver the whole time you had a driver. Whenever you wanted to leave the hotel. Wesley was there with me that year. He had that horse. I think he ran third in the race. But, yeah, it was a good time.
They're talking about this is going to be the 20th anniversary of the World Cup events, and I guess next year's going to be absolutely insane. They've got a lot of stuff planned.
Really?
Yeah. So yeah.
You'll
get yourself a horse.
Yeah. You definitely have to get back there.
I was trying to get Hartwood to jump his numbers. There's a number that they have to hit on it's not a buyer number. There's a number that Martin Panza was trying to explain to me even last year, that there's a number that they have to hit to be in consideration. It's some world number. And when Hartwood was running a couple of those good races, he was just underneath that number. Mm. You know, not that we would have taken him, but it would have been fun. It's, you know, fun to go over there.
Were those your only two trips to Dubai?
Yes.
We call her one?
Yes.
Yeah. So to get back there would be pretty special.
Oh,
you're,
sure.
You're a perfect two for two in
exactly.
Dubai.
Exactly.
That's your track.
Yeah.
You got to take a winner. You can't take any losers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to break the streak.
Yeah.
That's pretty special and quite a run with Collar One, who was a special horse in his own right, but he wasn't your first graded stakes winner, right?
No.
That was, what was a Hollywood Picture?
She probably, yeah, she was around that time. Yeah. I ended up, we had Western Pride after that. I had a filly we bought for $3,000 that won the grade two at Del Mar. I ran her, I stuck her in and ran her for 40 with, I always wanted a win picture with Lafitte. And so it might have even been during that time when I was there, but so I had this two-year-old filly that we didn't get sold at the sales, at the two-year-old sales, and she was a monster. She was by Pioneering. And so I told Lafitte, I think it might have been the time I was in Dubai, but I told Lafitte, I said, I have one you cannot lose on. And I'd done everything. I'd had her in behind horses, over the top of the rail, stopped, restarted. And so we ran her for, I think it was maiden 40, and she won off the TV screen. And then her next start was in the grade two Sorrento, I think, at Del Mar, and she won that just as far.
Should be wearing a mask.
But I think she might have been one of the first ones.
Yeah, pretty special moment there, and it's a career that James Chapman has enjoyed. There have been so many highs. He talked earlier about dealing with some of the lows that come with being a horse trainer. James, what do you like most about training racehorses?
I just love the horses. You know, winning's great, but I like to try to figure horses out. And buying cheaper horses with pedigree like I try to do. I mean, when I was younger, I'd steal vet wraps out of the tack room when I was 7 or 8 years old and put them on the broodmares out in the field and chase them up and down the field and try to figure out why one was running down in the left hind and not the right hind. But I just like trying to figure horses out, fixing problems. And young horses, I like, doing the whole thing to where I break them at my farm and get them right off the bat to where, that's what I like about it.
Is there a horse that you would say was probably your most challenging horse to figure out and you finally got it all squared away and the horse became pretty good?
Probably a filly that won my first stake was a filly named Unreal Squeal. We bought her. She was my first batch of horses that I scrounged up some money to go buy. But she wouldn't go around the turn. And so we ran her in a, to make a long story short, she ran in a 2-furlong race and you can't use blinkers or a whip there, but it was a straightaway. And she, Mike Hunter rode her. She won fast time. And so the next place to run is in the nursery stakes over at Hollywood Park where they got to go around the turn. And if she did not have blinkers on, she would not go. She was a real nasty filly. So you can't add blinkers off of a win. Well, we weren't allowed to use them in the maiden race going 2 furlongs. So the stewards gave us permission and they let us use blinkers and she won the stake by 7 or 8 lengths. But that was a challenging horse. I mean, there's been so many of them. There's been a lot of them.
It's really rewarding, isn't it, when you have a horse that needs some figuring out and whatever, and you turn it around. It's obvious, from this conversation that you love horses. So talk about that feeling that you get when you do something nice for a horse, where you get that horse happy. And
well, I mean, the prime example, there's two horses. One is a horse called Innovative that bought my first two houses, and then there was Caller One. Caller One, we worked him 27 days out from the Dubai race. Corey Nakatani, we were figuring out how to get it done because he wasn't a very sound horse. And so there's no medication over there. So he said, let's do what we did with re-race. He said, let's work him out of the gate 3/4. I'm like, work him out of the gate 3/4. So anyways, I listened. We did it. So my point being is that horse couldn't train. He didn't train much. If you wanted to watch him gallop, you weren't going to watch him work. If you wanted to watch him work, you weren't going to watch him gallop. So he did a lot of jogging and working and running. But that was one horse. We went over to Dubai, and everybody was breezing their horses. Frankel had aptitude, and there was a lot of horses. And I just jogged every day, stood him in the gate, jogged every day. But he had never turned around for like 26 days. He just jogged. And then the other horse was a horse called Innovative. Same way, soundness issues, and I claimed him off of Hollendorfer for 20, and they said Hollendorfer used to, when he watched him run, he used to stand at the TV with the racing form and beat the TV to hoping that he'd get beat because he ended up winning like 15 races for me and made like $350,000. But he was the same kind of horse. I'd run him up to, he ended up getting claimed one time for 62.5, and then I'd watch him come back down and I'd reclaim him for 10 and run him back up to 50 and he'd run him in stakes and stuff. But he was the same thing. He was just, and my program doesn't work on some horses. Some horses like Mel Studi's horses, they used to love to train. I claimed the horse off of him. It's called Fearless Pirate. And he'd been working the horse in 45 and 57. I was like, wait till I get this horse and back off his train. He wouldn't come out of a jog. I mean, he wouldn't run at all for me. It's just, It's funny. I mean, some horses, like some take to it and some don't.
He was tough to claim off of. I claimed one off of him. I thought, man, oh man, this is going to be ice cream.
Yeah. Let him walk for 5 days.
Somebody claimed him off me right away, and that was good because he finished last the only time I ran him. And Fernando Toro said, I should give him my saddle too.
Another person you don't want to claim off of is Julio Canani. I claimed the horse Singular Vision. And I was going to teach him how to, you know, do something different. Couldn't get him out of the barn.
Why is that there's certain trainers they say, hey, you don't want to claim off of this trainer? What? Why?
We were in Dubai with Julio Canani. He said, I got the Coco Lees. I got the Coco Lees. Who knows what it is? It's all probably smoke and mirrors. But some horses, like certain things. Some,
If folks are just joining us here on Trainer Talk, we're visiting with trainer James Chapman, who began his career as a rider. And in the first half of the show, we talked about your riding career a little bit. And you said there's no greater feeling than riding a horse in a race. How about the feeling of winning a race as a trainer, seeing all your hard work come to fruition when that horse crosses the finish line? Does it compare?
Yes. I mean, especially horses that we buy that, it's like, we fooled, we found something that they didn't see because of purchase prices and stuff. I mean, that's fun. That's fun to watch horses run up the ladder and that, beat a horse maybe that was paid X amount of dollars for. But, yeah.
Well, you think about everything that you've been through, the highs, the lows. We touched on some of that stuff earlier. And you look back on this career and all the greatest stakes wins and all the victories. What's the moment that you're just never going to forget for whatever reason?
The Dubai was, that was great. Just winning races, winning races. I like selling horses and winning races. I don't know if there's... Winning my first race as a jockey is something I'll never forget. Winning races on big stages is what I like.
It's funny how you talked about the horse that bought your first two houses. Bill Mott, when he was on this program years ago, he talked about Theatrical being the horse that got him started and helped to put him on the map and helped to get his family through school, his kids through school and all that kind of stuff. And there's always that one horse that kind of helps a trainer get kickstarted.
Exactly. That was mine. I mean, there was a bunch of them along the way, but that was a horse that I owned myself. We claimed him back. I think I had a partner, but it's gratifying to do that.
What about a horse that was maybe your best training job that nobody else knows about? Not a famous horse or anything, just some horse that you got along the way that you really feel like you did an exceptional job with?
Well, like I say, probably that horse Innovative. I mean, if you look that horse's stats up, I mean, it was incredible. I mean, he would win down the hill. He'd win on the dirt. And then, like the times I did lose him, and I ended up claiming him back at the end of his career to retire him, because the last time he got claimed, I think the Outrider that was trained at LaSalle took him,
John
and
Cortez.
He fractured his sesamoid. And I was like, let me just give you half the money back. And he's done. He said, you'll see him next year. And I waited, and we'd watch him run at Los Alamitos, and my wife would say, he's back in. And he was in for like six. I said, he'll be. And you'd see the horse was protecting himself. And finally we took the horse for, I think he got him back for $3,000, whatever the cheapest claiming price was. And I took him with me to Florida, and he actually died last year. That's a horse that sticks out to me other than Caller One. The Heartwood, the horse I have right now, I mean, he's made $400,000 the last year and a half since I bought him from out of the Horses of Racing Age sale in July. I mean, he's actually, if you look at my list of horses, he's right underneath Caller One and Western Pride for my all-time earners. Mm-hmm. And he's a really nice horse, and he's going to keep doing well. He's on a little break right now, but, I mean, that horse is going to have a huge year at the end of this year.
Yeah, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about Western Pride, a horse that was a two-time greatest stakes winner, 10 of 32 lifetime, earned $1.2 million. Talk a little bit about him for a
minute. I didn't get him till after his three-year-old year because he won the West Virginia Derby with another guy that was training mm-hmm. for the people that I had trained for. He was just a tough horse. My dad bought him as a two-year-old in training sale. In Florida, and he was just a tough horse.
Yeah, one of those horses that when you send him out there, you know what you're going to get, right?
Yeah, another good horse I had was a horse called I Say Pete that won the Pomona Derby. And That's a horse that I always go back to, like when I have a horse that's not breezing well before they start, that's bred to run long. I waited all the way to Del Mar when they had the first mile race because the horse would not work at all. And I ran him the first time and it was like, you know, hope he doesn't get hit by the ambulance. And he kicked off and came flying and finished second. And people came over to look at him to buy in the receiving bar, and he's limping behind. And he had actually ran so hard because he hadn't been running at all in the mornings that he fractured his tibia. So we gave him time and brought him back. But that horse went on to win Calder Derby and sold him for a lot of money to the McNairs, and then they let me keep him for the Hollywood Derby, and then he went and he ran his first race in the Broward against Horse Chestnut when Horse Chestnut won the Broward. But he was a neat horse. He was a neat horse.
There was a gap from 2014 to 2017 when you weren't training horses. What was going on then?
Well, the whole California thing with OSHA was coming out and telling all the people working for us that they needed to take a 10-minute coffee break every hour and days off and time cards and this and that. And I was making a lot of money selling 2-year-olds. And I started looking at my client list and it was like, I owned almost everything. And I was like, you know what? I had made money with a house there. So we put the house on the market. The kids were going to start school and we just decided to move back to Florida where my dad had a place there. And we took all our money and bought a farm in Florida and kind of kept the 2-year-old buying and selling 2-year-olds and yearlings. And I did that for a long time and did really well at it. And then,
eventually decided it was time to get back involved.
Yeah. Yeah, it got boring. The heat drove me crazy down there. I lost a lot of money in 2014 buying too much, you know, horses that cost too much money. I was buying, what do they call it, retail, not wholesale.
Yeah.
And then I like the action. It's like you get up in the morning there and it's like you just, there's nothing to do. Mow the grass only so many times. And it's, you walk into the barn.
Best lawn in Florida.
Yeah.
You walk into the barn at 5 a.m. and the horses are sweating with the fans on in August, prepping yearlings. And it's like, you know, that the winters are tough here, but as long as you dress, I dress for it in the morning and know it's going to be cold. And I love it here.
Tell me about your place here.
It's just up from Gainesway, right past the training center. It's 17 acres, small. It's really nice. It fits. It's, you know, like I say, it's close to the training center. I've got 30 there and a bunch of yearlings to sell. And this year, to whatever I'm going to do, you know, decide to do with them. And it works out fine.
Will you still do some pin hooking?
Yeah. I sold, I think, 15 yearlings last year that I had bought. And then we bought horses to run and that are just turning 2 now. One of them's the filly that runs today. And just kind of try to keep it under one umbrella. There's a lot of places you can run from out of the training center there. It's a great racetrack, safe racetrack, good people. Keeneland owns it. So it's good.
It's nice too when you have the reputation that you do of selling horses out of your stable. So people know if they see a horse of yours that runs and they like it, they can come to you and they don't have to feel weird about asking.
There's a niche that's out there that's not filled, and it's like the horse that can be bought for $75,000 that breaks their maiden. You know, they're either not for sale or they want $250.
Right.
And I'd like to, with what I buy my horses for, you know, they're going to know that they've got, you know, they might not be perfect in their right front, or, you know, there might be this little vet issue on the x-rays, but I want them to know that they can come and, you know, buy the $100,000 horse that won at Keeneland, or that, you know, that it's not going to be, oh, it's not for sale, or, you know, that's an area that nobody does, I don't think.
Right.
You know, they get high on them, and I've had enough horses to know that, you know, they need, you know, you need to move them on sometimes.
So what's the goal moving forward for James Chapman? What do you want to accomplish? How many horses do you want to have? Where do you see it going?
I always like to own what I have in the barn, a piece of something that I always like to have my teeth in the game.
Yeah.
And I'm happy what I'm doing. I buy some weanlings and resell them as yearlings, or I buy yearlings and take them and break them. And I don't really like the 2-year-old game now. It's just gotten to me, it's gotten to where there's only a couple people for the real money that buy them, and everybody's kind of started to partner up, and you'll see, you know, you'll see Ashford with Stone Street, and there's, so you've, t- to, and you got to pay a lot more to get the big horse, to get the big sale, to where, you know, before I did a lot, you know, I bought Atlantic Ocean back in 99 for 31,000. She sold for $1.9 million. I mean, it's hard to do that with, like, she was Stormy Atlantic. It was his first year. It's just hard to do that. The buyers have kind of, it's just changed. The 2-year-old thing scares me a little bit right now.
Yeah, the works have gotten crazy.
Yeah, it's like 9 and 4 is like a normal work anymore. Yeah. I mean, I can make them go fast, but it's like to stand out, I can't go an 8 and change. Yeah. And that's what you
And it, I mean, if you had a rider breeze your horse in 9 and change, you would kill them when they came back, and you would get off for justifiable homicide, right? Yeah. I mean, I just don't understand the mentality of that. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But when you do what you do, there's always people that want to get in the business, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know where they can get a horse
right
in their budget that, you know, that the average person could afford. As you mentioned, 75,000 or 100 or whatever they got to spend, and you provide that.
The funny thing about it is at the sales, and the way I look at it is, whenever you pay over $80,000 for a horse, you're saying that you can go compete with a horse that was a $500,000, because you're not buying that horse for $80,000 to run for maiden 25.
Right, right.
So it's like, you see what I'm saying? It's like, it's tough to compete. So I would rather buy lower than that, and then if I would get lucky, you know.
Yeah, if you can get something up to even $50,000, you have maybe a place to run.
Right.
You know,
because you still have the expenses to get there, and then, you know, they don't all turn out.
And for all the winners, there's losers. People don't ever talk about the fact that, you know, you buy a horse and it doesn't pan out. The horse is slow. There's nothing you can do about a slow horse.
Yeah. You know? So they're like cars.
Yeah.
There's Porsches and there's Volkswagen.
How many times have we said just to get a horse to the races is a major accomplishment? Forget about winning the Kentucky Derby or winning a stakes race. Just to get a horse in the starting gate is a major accomplishment.
It is.
You have to have a lot of luck.
Yep. A lot of luck and a lot of patience and be willing to lose.
Well said. Well said. James Chapman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, James, we have about 3 minutes left in the program, and we like to wrap things up by asking trainers to tell us something about themselves that people might not know. So outside of the horse racing side of things, what other interests do you have? Do you follow other sports? Do you like to go on vacation someplace? What do you like to do?
There's not a lot outside of that with me. It's been a little problem in my personal life, but there's not a whole lot of excitement, to be honest with you. I like spending time with my horses. I like going to the barn. It's like I'll be taking a nap at 11 o'clock when we're not running, and 20 minutes later the phone ring, my wife will be like, "Where are you?" And I'm like, "At the barn." But yeah, that's just, I don't really follow sports. No.
Your wife sounds like she's into the game. Is she?
She was Charlie Whittingham's rider for Strode's Creek and Flawlessly Sonya.
So
she's been in it the whole time.
Yeah.
So she gets it.
Yes.
Does she ever help out around the barn?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she helps out with everything. Yeah, she's good. She's good.
Yeah. To be able to ride those kind of horses, too, that's pretty special.
Yeah.
Be able to say she's somebody that's been able to do that.
And you always need good people behind you. I mean, I've got two guys that have been with me from the beginning, Stan Urigami and Stuart Tujimoto. You always need core people that you know that are there with you. They've been with me since I started in 95. Stuart Tujimoto, I mean, he's like my father. He's a great guy. And there's never like, where are you running this horse and why did we pay that? And he's running for this. It's just, you know, not that he doesn't care, but he trusts me, and he has his business, and he loves the horses. Unless you have that, it's really tough to make it nowadays. You need to have that core person to help you to know that they're not second guessing, you know, why this or why that, because that's tough for me when I get up at 3:30 every morning, and I've had guys like call me and say, "Well, why this?" Or not that they can't have their opinion, but just off the wall stuff that'll just drive you crazy. You got to have good people around you.
Well, James, you've done that, and you've done it at a high level for a very long time. Continued success. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio. Really appreciate the visit, and all the best moving forward.
Thank you.
All right, Trainer James Chapman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Fun visit, JT.
Absolutely. I love it when my friends come in.
every show we learn something new too. It's just one of those things about Trainer Talk. Really appreciate you listening. If you missed any portion of the show, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. It's all there for you, Horse Racing Radio. hrn.net. And remember to follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter and now on Instagram as well. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for our special guest, James Chapman, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.